Dr. Afua Cooper, thank you for joining me.
You're welcome.
In a previous interview with CBC, you referenced Malcolm X's experience in high school, I'd say, what, around 1940 in Michigan, and him being asked by a teacher what he wanted to do. And when he responded that he wanted to be a lawyer, the teacher basically almost laughed at him, saying, "Be realistic. How about being a carpenter?" And you challenged the education system here in Canada, saying that things are not really that much better for black students. You call it a national disgrace. Why?
Well, I mean, if we look at the statistics that are coming out of places, municipalities that have large black population, Toronto, Montreal, Halifax, and these stats and these reports are telling us that, you know, upwards of 60% of black students are dropping out, not graduating, then that is a national disgrace. That's a call for concern. And what bothers me or what disturbs me is that there doesn't seem to be an alarm. No one seemed to be raising the alarm that something is wrong here, that we're losing generations of young people, that their futures are being blighted, because without high school, you can't go nowhere, right? Without having an education, you really cannot envision or even have a decent future. So that disturbs me a lot. So that's a disgrace. But no one seems to care.
What would you like to see happening?
You know, in all of these reports, recommendations were made. I can think of one or two here in Halifax of having cultural appropriate content in the curriculum. That's one. But like I said in that CBC interview, that's important. Seeing yourself in the curriculum is important. You know, when the book Little Black Sambo was part of the curriculum in many school boards across this country, it really, really hurt black kids and lowered their self-esteem and all of that. But I'm also proposing that even if there's no cultural specific or culturally relevant content in the curriculum, and if the teacher taught with compassion and taught with love and saw each and every child in that class as somebody good, somebody worthy, somebody deserving of goodness and of, you know, her attention and her love or his love, whatever, then each child, I think, would come out of school feeling empowered, feeling strong, feeling worthy and having high self-esteem. What we have now with many African-Canadian students is that there's no expectation. Teachers have very low expectations of them. I work with high school students. I see them. I talk to them. 20 years ago, we heard some discourse. Today, we're hearing the same thing. We're hearing students saying teachers don't call on them when they raise their hands. We're hearing students saying when they write an essay and take it in and it's a top-notch essay, teachers will say, "Are you sure you wrote that?" That kind of thing. We're seeing people being passed through the ranks, you know, moving on through the grades without being able to read properly, without having proper numeracy skills or adequate numeracy skills. So something is wrong. The system is rotten. And if you look at a school board like Toronto, that's a Toronto district school board, not the Catholic district, but the non-Catholic, their budget is $2 billion a year, $2 billion. So you're spending a lot of money and there are specific populations that are failing. Somebody needs to be held accountable. And that's not happening.
Toronto, in that school board, they have a black-only school.
And that school, it's only one school, by the way, and it's the results are fantastic.
And when it was being suggested and formed, there was a great deal of controversy around it. But if you're saying the results are there, what does this say about what has to happen?
Exactly. The results are that school, the kids in that school are performing two levels above their age group. Because, you know, of course, the media went in and the board and educationists and so on. Their math skills are great. They're reading, you know, children in grade two are reading at the grade four level because somebody is paying attention to them. Somebody's telling them that they're worthy. Someone is saying to them that they have value. And someone, the African Canadian community, is in charge of their education and will not see them slip through the cracks or go down a tunnel. But black children, by and large, in the Canadian school system, are allowed to fail. And the newer research are now talking about the school-to-prison pipeline. That's what educationists, the researchers from places like OISE are talking about now. It's a school-to-prison pipeline. And some people say, oh, well, that sounds like a conspiracy. But then look at the statistics. If it's a conspiracy, is it true? Where so many African-Canadian young people are being funneled into the criminal justice system, into jails. And as we all know, again, researchers who research prison and the correctional institutions will tell you that something like 70% of the inmates are functionally literate or can't read. That says something.
That's a very frightening phrase, school to prison pipeline.
Absolutely, it is. But, you know, people like Bairu Siam, who was a teacher in the Toronto public system for over 20 years, and he came out and he wrote his memoirs. And I can quote from his book because the book is out there and one can read it. And he talks about the special resources room. They have a word for it, that room where, you know, the children who are not doing so well, they put them in there and they work with the teacher. Well, in theory, nothing is wrong with being sent into that program. If you're performing at a low level in math, you can be sent there, or English, whatever. It's supposed to rehabilitate you. But when you're in that program for 4 years of your career, high school career, and you know when you graduate from that program, you can't even go to community college, then that's a problem. But what I wanted to say that he talks about in his book is that in a particular school where he taught, he noticed when the black kids were coming in, you know, September, the first day of school, by the first week of school, they're all in that in the resource room. And he would say to his peers and his superiors, why are those kids being put in the resource room? I teach some of them history, and they're quite bright. And then one teacher said, look, we have to use a resource room. If we don't put kids in there, then we're going to lose our funding for that program. It's kind of called a dumb program.
Wow, so they're just funneled.
It's the black kids who were being funneled into that program, not because they were dumb, quote-unquote, but because it's all about money. The school doesn't want to lose the money that the board gives them for these resource room programs. And the children that they feel should go in that it's this idea that comes from the time of slavery that black people are intellectually inferior.
Mm-hmm.
So don't even let them finish grade 9 and see what they're capable. We'll just put them in the underachievers program right away. Just put them there. And he thought, oh, my God, do you realize what you're doing to these children? In Nova Scotia, we have something called IPP, Independent Personal program or something. It's where you as a student craft your own high school program.
Mm-hmm.
You take a course here. Now, when a child comes in grade 9 or grade 10, how can they craft their own program? This is something that should be done in conjunction with the parents. So we find a lot of the African Nova Scotian kids are funneled into IPP. And the thing about IPP is that IPP gets you nowhere, nowhere. You can't go to a trade school, you can't go to a community college, you can't go to university. And that's what we see our kids being funneled into.
So it's a dead end.
The teachers will say, it's a great program. You don't have to come to classes. You can go to English and read a book for the English course. Of course, which 15-year-old is going to go to the library and really sit and read a book? which 15-year-old can seriously say, I'm doing an independent program? That's what you do when you're in university, mm-hmm. fourth year, and you do an independent study with the professor. But that's what's happening in our school system.
Are black parents beginning to demand more?
Black parents are beginning to demand more, and that's why you have the school we mentioned in Toronto. I think there's also a high school. The first school is a primary elementary school. I think there's now a high school in
yes.
Scarborough. And as you mentioned, the resistance that came up, people talk about, oh, we don't want to segregate and this and that. And so people are saying, but wait a minute, why do you think we have girls' school? Why do you think we have boys' school? Why do you think we have religious schools? Religious institutions. There are all kinds of quote-unquote segregated schools in Canada, but no one is seeing them as such. But when we're having schools established on the basis of race or ethnicity, or rich people see that as a problem. But I see that as part of the whole anti-black racism that's pervasive in Canada. Recently, McLean's pointed out Winnipeg as the most racist city in Canada. And that may or may not be true, you know, again, but it's specifically about Aboriginal people. And anyone who's been to Winnipeg and lived there for any length of time know that, you know, Aboriginal people are treated harshly in Manitoba and in Winnipeg.
Yeah, there is a problem.
There is a problem. But what about African Canadians? What's the most racist city in Canada for African Canadians? Is it Halifax, as some would say? Is it Toronto? Is it Montreal? Is it Edmonton? So that's one question that I think the Canadian state and the Canadian elite do not want to touch.
You know,
the marginalization of African Canadian communities in this country, especially of the young people.
The kids in Montreal and, you know, now in the National Hockey League, PK Subban is a big hockey star,
yeah.
And his father from the Caribbean was a school principal, and education was very important. And again, it's still that sports education dichotomy, but the education is an aspect. Do you see things changing in any way there?
In the sports or in education?
In, again, maybe bringing the two of them together, where some of these sports stars are role models, but education is a very important aspect of their career.
Well, I see that if you have a talent for a sport and, you know, you can make it, whatever that means, certainly go for it. There's nothing wrong with sports. Sports is great. It's unfortunate that in the school system all across this country, we are cutting out sports and music from the curriculum. When there are cuts, it's sports and music that take the fall. So I strongly support an education that integrates sports, music, arts, and so on. But yes, absolutely. And a coach worth his or her salt will say to the students, you know, you're talented as a volleyball player, as a hockey player, great, I will support you on that, but you have to get your education. You have to get your high school. You have to get whatever, because you can be injured, and in the twinkling of an eye, your career can be over. And we see that happening to many sports personalities or aspiring superstars, that they get an injury, and that's it for them. And at the end of the day, they probably cannot read or write properly. But we look at some of these young people who make it in the sporting world, people like PK, and he still has to be the proper Negro, the happy Negro, because the media gets at him. They are detractors who needles him. He can't seem, you know, to just be a regular sports guy. And in fact, he's a role model. He's a model of sobriety and calmness and gentleness and all of that. He's really not like some of these rough and ready sporting superstars who can do anything and are forgiven by the public. PK is under the scrutiny. He's always under surveillance. And it's quite unfortunate, actually, because even as you give to Canada and bring gold medals for Canada, you know, if you make this simplest, the slightest mistake, you're criticized, you're penalized, you're called ungrateful, and so on. So there is a problem of racism in this country. I'm glad the Maclean magazine did that, because at least it's an acknowledgement of racism to some degree. But unfortunately, we are not ready to talk about it. And we are not ready to talk about it, but the populations that suffer from it, that are victimized, are paying the cost. The highest incarceration rate of there's one realm in which we have equity in this country,
and
not
is?
Equality, but equity, in which African Canadians have equity, and it's in the criminal justice system. It's in the prisons. We have equity in the prisons, as I often say to my friends and my students. We struggle to have equity in the teaching staff, in nursing, in banking, in the financial world. Even when there are measures put in place to have equity, there are other measures set in place to undermine those measures. But we have equity in the prisons. So the prisons is one place where you see African Canadian men and women coming up now. No problems there. There's no problem there. Put them in prison. It's not a fool Cooper saying it. You look at what the commissioner, that's not his proper title, of Corrections Canada. His last name is Saper, S-A-P-E-R, and he talks about that in the report. The high incarceration rate of African Canadian men and on the prairies of Aboriginal people, and what's happening? Why is that happening?
Mm-hmm.
Harsher sentences. Fewer payroll opportunities, and so on. Over policing, we've seen the stop and frisk, the carding that was happening in the Greater Toronto Region. That as you step out on the street as a black man, you're pulled over by the cops, and all your information are entered in the supercomputer. It's not like they're looking for a criminal. Or someone reported a shop being broken in.
Well, it's
you step out and you walk and you're immediately criminalized.
It's become the catchphrase. What is it? DWB, driving while black.
Driving while black. But there's also walking while black. And so there's very little security for black people in this country, especially for black men, visible black men.
Let's talk about...
It's an undermining of our democratic rights.
Let's talk about Black History Month. We're at the beginning of another one. It's been 20 years now in Canada. Is this doing anything to help?
I don't know. I actually don't know. Well, I have to be optimistic, and I have to say yes, because when you do these Black History Month events and people come out, sometimes they bring their kids, and they said, I learned a lot. And maybe Black History Month is not so much for white people. Maybe it's for black people. So black people can learn their history and empower themselves and be fortified by the lessons that they learned from their heroes, like, you know, whoever their heroes are. So maybe it's for black people. Maybe it's not to teach white people, because if you look at opportunities over the decades for some communities, they have actually dwindled. And the high dropout rate, as an educator myself, that frightens me. It no longer disturbs me. It frightens me that we're losing generations of people. And in terms of community development and community empowerment, what does that mean? So I'm not sure things have gotten better. I think there are institutions within the state that, like the educational institution and the justice institution, that are doing a great disservice to the African Canadian community, and in many ways are deliberately breaking that community through the measures that they have enacted in keeping these people in their place.
Oh, we can't end on that note.
No, let's be upbeat.
Well, on the other hand, if that's really the way you see it, if that's exactly what you're seeing.
Well, that's what I'm seeing, and that's what I'm feeling. You know, I see a lot of lip service. I'm an educator, I'm an artist. You know, I move between these realms and I'm in these circles, and I see people write beautiful documents on equity and equality and all of that. And the discourse is there, of course. But when it comes to implementation, this is where the problems arise and the resistance. And then 5 years down the line, you see some of these equity measures abolished or cut, and we're right back to where we started. So that's what I'm seeing. You know, I'm in the front line.
But I have to say, what I'm seeing on the other side as a Canadian sitting on the couch watching television, for example, I'm seeing a lot more black people on commercials, thank goodness, in the sense that, you know, whether they're driving cars or shopping in a grocery store, they're much more visible now than maybe even 5 years ago. And I see young kids, you know, I have daughters finishing high school and college, and they're all going to school together. And I do see a new generation getting a better, longer education.
I would not disagree with that. We do see more people on TV. I teach undergraduates, people who are about to leave school. And I'm always disturbed by how little they know
About what?
about their country, even about quote unquote white history. You know,
It is a hard subject to teach, and I would not argue with you there. It is quite
and
shocking
so
that they don't know.
they don't know. And when it comes to minority history or black, it's like forget that. So I'm thinking, but you're gonna go out there in the world. You're gonna be working in a few months. You're gonna be in these situations. As you said, all the young people now are together. You're going to be an employer or an employee, and you're so unprepared. There's very little cultural competencies. Well, no cultural competency is being taught in school. So while it's great that the kids go to school together and hopefully they socialize and visit each other, in the realm of pedagogy, that's not happening. It's still a dominant view of the world. And when I say dominant, I mean, you know, coming from a white perspective. So, I mean, we can say that there is resistance, that there's a lot of black community organizing. People are organizing in terms of education, in terms of employment opportunities. Lots of young people are engaged. If you look at the last year when we had the municipal elections in Toronto, there were something like 8 African Canadian young people that ran in that election. One young woman, Munira Abukar, actually ran against the mayor. You know, she lost, but I applaud her because just to have that cheek of running against the then mayor of the city. And she was 22 years old. And when you look across the GTA, there were all these young black people running, you know, for various positions. So that is wonderful. I've never seen that before. That is new. The amount of people, there's this critical mass, and people are willing now to engage a political process. And we see, you know, I am on Facebook, so I see all these news. Another black young woman appointed to Catherine Wynne's Council on Youth Opportunities. So many young people, they're moving ahead, they're seizing the opportunities, they're going to school, they're getting educated, they're getting their degrees, and that's great, and that's wonderful. So we applaud that and we celebrate that.
And I would say that Black History Month has something to do with it because it has become part of the curriculum in schools pretty well across Canada. And children are learning about each other. The fact that children in Nova Scotia know that the Black community has been present since the beginning of European contact with North America, that changes their sense of belonging.
Yes, if it is taught in school. There are many schools now that have actually abolished Black History Month.
Is that so?
Yeah. Many, many schools are not commemorating it anymore. My daughter went to two high schools in Halifax, and nothing happened for Black History Month. I thought it was a given, so I went to the principal and I said, well, what's going on? And he said, oh, the teacher who used to do Black History Month moved and went to another school, and we're not doing Black History Month this year.
So it all depends on one person's initiative.
It depended on one person. And then a new principal came, and there was no Black History Month. And my daughter took it up and said, look, it's sort of part of the school board policy. And she read the HRM school board policy. She said in 1996, Honorable Jean Augustine got this passed in the federal parliament. Why aren't we not having Black History Month commemorations when we have other commemorations? And she was met with a blank stare. So, you know, and when I lived in Ontario, I was one of the parents that was that helped to organize the events in the school. I was in the schools all the time. But it gets tiring. It really gets tiring because the teachers and the school administration do not feel that that it's something valuable that they should pursue every year. They're like, oh, we did it last year or whatever. Some schools are pretty good, but what we see, and in fact, people here in HRM, meaning Halifax Regional Municipality, mm-hmm. Black parents and some teachers are saying, yes, this is a trend that's happening across the city.
I'm surprised to hear that.
I'm saying sometimes...
And I'm disappointed to hear that.
It's two step forward and four step backwards. To the point where I personally just gave up. I'm like, I'm not fighting any primary school or high school to have Black History Month. I spent the greater part of my life doing that.
Well, Dr. Afua Cooper, thank you for joining me and thank you for telling me about it.
You're welcome.